Hello, everybody. Welcome back to another Bald Move Prestige. Today, we're going to be talking about the horror thriller Misery that was unleashed on an unsuspecting audience back in November 30th, 1990. That's right. 30 years of misery have we endured on this planet. Of course, this was directed by Rob Reiner, based on a screenplay by William Goldman. They're teaming back up after Princess Bride and many, many other fruitful endeavors, and also based on a novel, Misery, by Stephen King. Stars James Caan, Kathy Bates. This is like kind of her debut role. And Lauren Bacall taking a role again as James Caan's literary agent, because this is essentially Stephen King, the worst fear. Jim,
okay.
What's your relationship with Misery? And what'd you think of it this time around?
I've definitely seen it before. I just don't remember how many times. And it surprised me because I thought I remembered more of this movie than I did. And the only scene that stuck out in my head is that hobbling scene.
Right.
Which I think is like the film defining scene. It's what everybody remembers. But I love it. I think it holds up just as well. It's just as terrifying. Kathy Bates is just as amazing now as she was in 1990. I was still thoroughly impressed with this movie going back to it 30 years later. How about you?
I have never seen this movie before.
What?
And of course I knew about the hobbling scene. That's something that, like, you know, it gets out in pop culture and it's like, man, is it going to be now? Is it going to be now? Is it going to be now? And I really liked it. I thought like the tension really holds up. I think some of the filmmaking looks kind of creaky or basic. And I wonder if that's because they were doing, like, Rob Reiner is intentionally imitating like a 1970s kind of aesthetic to make it feel like it's a little bit of a throwback or to make it feel like a little bit of a period piece. But also the 90s are right on that. They're like a threshold, you know, decade like the 70s were, where it's like you're not entirely 80s or not entirely 60s, and it's kind of a mishmash.
Oh yeah,
I don't know, but yeah, the performances between James Caan and Kathy Bates is really good. Kathy Bates plays just this psychotic character, just pitch perfect, like the way she veers between this saccharine niceness and this white hot rage and sadism. I thought it's also fun that, you know, we're covering Fargo. There is this Nurse Mayflower who has the exact same backstory as Kathy Bates in Misery. It's interesting to kind of see how these things line up. I thought that stuff was a lot of fun. It's a tough watch. Like, there's a lot of things where it's like, you know, James Caan's legs get fucked up so bad this movie.
Oh my God.
In the car accident, and like to where I thought, it's like, this guy's gonna lose his feet. Look at those feet. What's wrong with his feet, man?
It's funny that you say that. Apparently, in the book, the hobbling scene is different. She actually takes an axe to his foot, cuts it entirely off, and then cauterizes it with a blowtorch. So yeah,
Jim, spoilers on this 30-year-old movie. I can't believe we're just going to throw that out there. But yeah, no. If you're like me, you avoided seeing this movie. I can't imagine there's a person on earth that cares about movies at all that doesn't know.
Right.
In this movie, James Caan gets his ankles broke.
Yeah.
But Kathy Bates crosses him up on the basketball court. And he had no
game.
Ankle broken. Just like it's like, and you know, she just trash talks relentlessly, never really recovers. It's pretty crazy what it does to his confidence. One little bit of historical fiction or little historical note is my defining memory of this film, not having seen it as a kid, because I was I'd be about 12 or 13 when this movie came out, maybe 14, is everyone said my mom looked like Kathy Bates. Like, throughout this entire era of Kathy Bates' career, up through Fried Green Tomatoes and Titanic, everyone said how much Kathy Bates looked like my mom. And like, I never saw it, but like watching this movie, I kind of did. And it really gave that movie an extra bit of like, oh, Jesus Christ, this is fucked kind of kick.
I don't remember exactly what your mom looked like back then, but
sure, blanked it from your mouth. Yeah, sure, I get it.
Sure, yeah, the too traumatic. I can't remember it. working with a therapist on that. No, but I don't remember ever thinking that. So that's a little surprising to me.
So, do you want? I guess we should. Should we kind of lay out the movie? If you haven't seen this movie, should we lay out what it's about and then kind of get into a detailed discussion of it?
Yeah, sure.
Misery is about a fiction writer who has this tradition where he checks into the same rustic cabin in the mountains to finish his manuscript, and he always orders a bottle of very expensive champagne, vintage, and he smokes one single cigarette with a particular Strike Anywhere match, and he has this whole celebration thing. And he has just recently published a book, because I guess he's had a whole series of books around the central romance figure, Misery. It's like a bodice ripper, you know?
I think so, yeah.
Yeah, like a middle-aged soap opera, you know, erotica novel. Harlequin. Mm. A Harlequin romance. And he's sick of it. He wants to write quote-unquote real novels. So he kills off Misery. Well, he's having his celebration of writing his first real novel. A blizzard hits. He's driving home from the cabin retreat. He spins off the road, and he's rescued by Kathy Bates, who says, "I'm sorry, I'm a nurse. I can take care of you, but the roads are closed. The phones are out. And you're stuck with me taking care of you." Mm-hmm. And that turns out to be a nice little horrific setting for a novel, to be completely at this person, this crazy, your number one fan.
Yeah.
You know, to be completely at their mercy for X amount of time. It's terrifying. And it really works on a psychological level. Where do you want to start?
I feel like I don't have a ton to say about this movie that isn't spoilery. I will say it was a success.
I think we can move into let's talk about that, because like I don't really know about like the movie's success or anything like that. I'd be interested.
So it's made by Castle Rock, which you probably recognize if you're a Stephen King fan, especially in the modern era where that show exists. The Castle Rock is a Stephen King thing. It's kind of like a small town in Maine where he sets a lot of his stories, or is mentioned a lot in his books. And apparently Rob Reiner founded this studio with some other people and called it Castle Rock as an homage to him, which I thought was interesting. And this film, when it came out, had a $20 million budget, and it made $61 million in the box office. So pretty successful, I'd say.
Tripled your money, sure.
For a small studio like Castle Rock. Although in the 90s, I'm not sure how small they were. They were bought a few times. But then, yeah, you talked about how Kathy Bates, was sort of an unknown at this time, although she had been working in and around Hollywood and like in TV shows and stuff, just as one-off characters for like 20 years. Like she started in 1970 as her first, screen credit, which shocked me because this is the thing. Like when you think of Kathy Bates, this is the thing that puts her on the map.
Yeah, absolutely.
James Caan, obviously already on the map, like he'd been at Godfather and a whole bunch of other things, and was a little reluctant, I guess, to take this film, although seems like he wasn't the only one. We'll talk about that in a little bit.
Yeah, there's a whole list. This movie was jilted at the altar more than I've ever seen a main role jilted. Oh, my God.
Yeah. I mean, we can talk about that now if you want, because William Golding wrote a book, I think, called like Four Screenplays with Essays or something, where he talked. He had the screenplay of this movie, and he talked in a few pages about the making of this movie and how it came together. And yeah, I've got like a list of the actors they wanted to consider for this and that all said no.
Yeah, William Hurt turned down the project twice. Kevin Kline, Michael Douglas, Harrison Ford, Dennis Hoffman, Robert De Niro, Al Pacino, Richard Dreyfuss, Gene Hackman, Robert Redford, and Warren Beatty.
Yeah.
All turn this movie down. That is like, and I we've talked about this before, like, you know, Tom Selleck turned down Indiana Jones and it went to Harrison Ford. Like every once in a while you have these like little things about, you know, what might have been. But this is by far the longest chain of custody of people playing hot potato with the role I've ever seen.
I guess it took them like 6 months to even cast. You know, this is a very small cast, and it took them 6 months to do it because of that.
I wonder why. Was like Stephen, because like, you know, I'm thinking of Stephen King and popular media. They haven't all been gems, but there's been a lot of like, you know, I feel like more hits than misses. In terms of like The Shining and Carrie and
I guess he's got a spotty track record for sure.
Was this late 80s, early 90s, like Stephen King, you know, like this is TV movie shit. This is like It and The Stand, you know, cheap, low budget.
Yeah, could be. I know also like the violence, particularly the hobbling scene, I know it turned some people off. I think they were considering I think Meryl Streep was considered for the Annie role.
Oh, that'd have been good.
And then shit, what's her name? Relentlessly like cheery Broadway star.
Bette Midler?
Yes. Bette Midler was considered for it. And she turned it down because, yeah, she couldn't see herself doing this dark material. Later said, I think, that it was a mistake.
It would have been interesting. But that's the thing. Like, you got to be able to turn like that off.
Yeah.
And I tell you, Kathy Bates is really good. And, you know, she's been a fixture on American Horror Story since like season 3. And she's had a lot of really fun, memorable character roles in that anthology. I think she actually has got a pretty good knack for playing this kind of sadistic, you know, saccharine character. She's really good at it anyway. Passive aggressive cruelty.
Uh-huh.
Sometimes aggressive aggressive.
Sure. It wasn't also just the actors that they had trouble with. They had trouble with the director too. Like, I think initially George Roy Hill, who directed The Sting, Butch Cassidy, Slapshot, if you're familiar, like did a run with Paul Newman and stuff. But he was originally slated to direct this thing, but he got to the hobbling scene and said, I can't do it. I can't see myself calling action on that scene. It's too much.
Isn't that weird? Like 1990s, we'd already been through Predator. We'd already been through Mando.
Yeah.
We've been through some crazy Chainsaw Texas Massacre. Mm-hmm. Like, this is not like 1950s. This is not Dick Van Dyke Show. I'm kind of shocked to hear these directors saying that. Maybe, I guess it's, you know, they hadn't done things like that. That's like more shocky, exploitative. You know, it's not a serious film.
Yeah, no. And so Rob Reiner just says, you know what? We could go out and find another director, but whatever, I'll just do it myself. And so that's how we got Rob Reiner directing this. And I think he did a fine job. Like you said, it's a little like workmanlike and utilitarian, but it worked for me.
Yeah. And they do the things they need to do, building the tension. They are able to do that. Very, very well.
Here's what's new in premium content for our club members.
Executive producers have a chance to exercise their rights under the Patreon pact we've made by voting for the next pulp movie that Jim and I will be covering. If you're one of the elite few backers at the executive producer level, don't miss your chance to influence us. Hurry over to patreon.com/baldmove and vote in the latest movie poll before it closes on Wednesday morning.
And for all other club members, we've got an all-new episode of Lunch with Jim and Aaron this Friday afternoon. Catch the live stream at 1 p.m. to interact with us and your fellow munchers over on Patreon, or you can wait for the podcast to drop later that day.
If you want even more Bald Move in your life, head over to support.baldmove.com to find out how you can get tons of bonus audio and video content, plus ad-free feeds.
Since the dawn of time, we've been putting clothes on our back that identify us with our people, our group, our tribe.
And while Bald Move might be one of the smallest, weirdest tribes out there, transcending all concepts of border, class, culture, and creed, we still have respect for the old ways.
At support.baldmove.com, you can get t-shirts, hats, mugs, and more. We have something for every one of our podcasts, or just wear the four pips of the Bald Move logo with pride.
Bald Move merch beats running around naked, and they make a great gift for the Bald Move fan in your life. Join our tribe! Head over to support.baldmove.com and click on merch to start shopping.
Do you want to talk about like the movie and kind of like just specific details?
Yeah, let's do it.
This is the first time I saw it, and when I see James Caan like wind up and nail a tree with a perfect snowball, I think, aha, and he says remarks to the camera, still got it. I'm like, aha, he's going to, and I just thought for sure when that sheriff came at the end, like he's going to have to like, there's going to be a baseball in the corner of the basement, and he's going to have to hit an 8-inch by 12-inch window and shatter it as the, just as the sheriff is getting out of earshot. No. James Caan is just feeling real good about himself and his masculinity in this scene. He just had a bottle of Dom Perignon, and he smoked his cigarette, and he's driving his Mustang way too fast down this winter mountain, and he can fucking nail a snowball for sure.
Yeah. I mean, the Mustang on that snowy mountain road is a terrible idea, and I knew it was a terrible idea. Like, you don't have to have much
wheel drive muscle car on a one-way switchback. Just, you know, you're a wealthy, famous author. Maybe just stay another couple nights. Maybe, I'm sure that's, it's 1990. This hotel has a fax machine.
Oh, you're going to fax how many pages? 300 pages?
This guy's worth millions of dollars, right? Yeah, even if you're paying 35 cents a page or whatever it was back in the day. Like, I don't think it was ever that expensive. Maybe sending, receiving.
It's not about the money. It's about the time you'll never get back. God, that would take ages. I guess you just hire the attendant to do it, and he does it for
the
next 6 weeks.
This movie would have to be a period piece nowadays. Like, I'm trying to think if you could tell the tale of misery. I don't think you could.
I mean, his cell phone breaks in the car crash, right? Like,
or if he's a guy like Tom Hanks who fetishizes typewriters and he can only do his man, you know, I guess you could still knock out that, and you know, what's he going to do, take a picture of the manuscript one at a time with a cell phone? But it's a lot harder to make a misery movie like even 3 or 4 years later than it was at the time.
Yeah, I mean, it's a real thing. Like, when she forces him to burn that manuscript, I'm thinking,
no,
God, this
control
is his
Z.
only copy of a work he spent months on, at least. That's a blow. That's a devastating blow.
I really love the bluffing, too, like, you know, that went on with, like, go ahead and say, I've sent out 12 copies already to my proofreaders and auditors, and she, as his number one fan, knows that's not your routine, Paul. Yep. I know that you only have the one thing because you're so fucking, and like, he just like, it does feel like a very particular paranoia coming out of Stephen King, but it's well placed. Oh, yeah. Like, I'm certain Stephen King has gotten some very creepy, giving the subject matter that he writes about and the way he writes about it. I'm sure he's gotten just the worst kind of like fan mail. That like sends shivers up your spine, and this has got to be the result of it, you know. Everything that you've said to like engender a relationship with your audience now used to imprison you. It's pretty wild.
Yeah, no, it's written from a uniquely like famous perspective, I guess. You don't get this kind of relationship without being someone of some notoriety. And I mean, there are a few ways to read this movie, right? One of them is it's a shot at overly enthusiastic fans who are going to be creeps. It could also be a shot at editors, right? You look at Annie sitting over his shoulder, sort of like second guessing every decision he's making, or, you know, getting too in the weeds with the details. Although I think her criticisms are somewhat fair. You know, you want a believable story. It could be a shot at writers who spend their entire career writing a single series of books, you know, and sort of use that as a crutch, maybe. There is a truth. I did read a little bit about Stephen King's comments on this movie or on the book and why he wrote it. I know that some of it is like Annie is supposed to reflect his cocaine addiction that he had at the time. And how had this hold over him that was unbreakable and was holding him, you know, hostage, a prisoner.
Damn, I thought the text with him was pretty on the nose. I had no idea this is yet another cocaine metaphor. Holy moly.
Yeah, it's that. It's also a reaction to the fans' reaction to his works where he tried to branch out into something other than horror fiction.
Right.
Where he did, like, The Eyes of the Dragon was one of his books where he tried to do epic fantasy. And you could probably look at, like, Dark Tower stuff that came probably later.
And then he got wise and came up with Richard Bachman. So it's like, fuck you people.
That's the thing. So this book was supposed to be written under Richard Bachman's pseudonym, but people discovered his true identity while he was writing this and said, fuck it, let's publish it as Stephen King.
Wow, because this is kind of like in the King wheelhouse, you know?
Yeah, yeah. But it's a little more grounded and real.
It's a little bit... And maybe autobiographical in the like terms of like the fears anyway.
Yeah, yeah. So there's a lot of that. It's a reaction to like the shit going on in his own life at the time, and also I think there you know this is a very writerly sort of thing. It's got a main character that is a writer. Right. I feel like writers do that a lot, and it can be bad and cheesy. But I didn't feel like it was here. It really worked.
No,
for
I thought. Yeah, I thought it was really good. I mean, like, there's a couple points where I'm like, well, why doesn't he just do this or that? And I felt like there was at every turn, because it is like, it is this wild kind of hostage situation where there's this, it's just like an interesting little duel where he tries to play psychological games with her. Like, you know, I think felt like a smart person dealing with a crazy person and seeing what he could get away with and seeing how he can manipulate her and then win. Cause she's not stupid too. She's pretty perceptive and she's also very paranoid and distrustful. And when she, you know, does find minor disobedience, she punishes it severely. And she makes this guy like that. He's entirely 100% reliant on her. You know, there's no way he could just like, they do a really good job to set up the plot and the story to where you really feel like a guy like James Caan is kind of helpless in the situation. And I guess that's one of the things that turned all these guys away is like they mentioned, like even Warren Beatty was interested in the role. It's like, but can I be less passive? Can I be more dynamic and take more of a role? But that's the whole movie. The fact that like this guy like James Caan, who plays a lot of big strapping alpha dudes, you know, fucking Sonny Corleone, the bull, that's so physically powerful and angry and, you know, action packed, is essentially hobbled and kept, you know, in this bed, like by this super mother figure.
Yeah.
But that's the fucking horror right there, you know?
For sure.
This medical captivity, this nurse ratchet, this involuntary committing to some mad person.
And Kathy Bates, I mean,
chilling.
My God, she's just incredible in this movie. She actually won. This movie was nominated for one Oscar, Best Actress, and she won it that year. Totally warranted, I think. Like, there are a couple of standout scenes, not even just the ones where she's like screaming in his face, you know, because that's pretty overt. But the one that got me was the lighter fluid scene where like she's, you know, telling him burn this book and she's not saying it, she's just okay, burn this book, and he says nah, I'm not gonna burn the book, and then she starts talking in this friendly tone but like drenching him, covering his bed in lighter fluid at the same time, and there's just like this implied, if you don't burn this book, I'm going to burn you. That is, he gets it, we get it. It's just such a perfect moment.
Got this thing where she sloshed, like I noticed that in the urine bottle scene, where she's like kind of sloshing it carelessly around. And like so the first time on that, I thought, well, maybe she's just like really cat. No, the lighter fluid makes it seem very deliberate that like, yeah, she's doing these things just to make him feel uncomfortable, be like, hey, if you don't start, you know, telling me the things I want to hear, you know, if I have to light this match, who knows what path it's going to take to get to this manuscript. You know, it might cross this lighter fluid soaked bed, or it's terrifying.
It is. And I love the escalation there. They go from, they start with soup, right? Like she maybe probably accidentally spilled soup on his bed, and then she's holding this bottle of piss and shaking it around, and James Caan is just eyeing it, right? He's like, that's a bottle of piss, you probably shouldn't be shaking that, but in my headcanon, he's remembering the soup spilling on the bed and just going, oh no, I don't want a repeat of that. And then it escalates to the lighter fluid, like you said, and it's, yeah, that escalates.
And even then, it's like, is it deliberate or is she just that careless? Because, like, it's a plot point that she spoils the poisoning attempt just by being clumsy.
Yeah.
And, like, so, like, there's also a neat little escalation between, like, initially he's charmed and kind of grateful that she saved him mm-hmm. and, you know, completely unquestionably buys a story about the roads being out and the thing. And thank God you're a nurse and you got this RV and his fucking legs are a horror show. Like, the way he gave her permission to read the manuscript, because he's like, he starts off as like, well, you know, I have this process and only my editor and my publisher and my agent get to read it. And also people who saved my life and fixed my legs up. Like, he's really charmed by her. And the very first scene where he feels unnerved is where she comes at him about the swearing mm-hmm. in his new novel. That's not Misery is this Anna Green Gables, very romantic and flower. You imagine the worst he might say is, you know, hell or damn. And maybe once or twice in a very dramatic where anyone could understand, you know, someone breaking into circumstances. But like the way she kind of gets a little unhinged in the anger, you know, when like, well, you know, everybody, that's just the way people talk. And no, they don't. And then see what you made me do, like instant, like the blame of like, her anger, like it's not her fault. It's really chilling stuff. And like I wonder if Kathy Bates is just like a straight up narcissistic bully, because god damn, she plays one so well in so many different things I've seen her.
Oh, for sure. And I couldn't help but feeling like the that, you know, there's no nobility in cursing is also another shot at editors trying to take some of that out of his books maybe early on or something.
Yeah, because you know, King likes to work blue. He's a little bald. Sure. He's got some bald move in him.
He works blue in his interviews, man. He's not afraid to curse.
Does he really?
Oh, yeah. And then the other thing about that, you know, that persona that she's got is this strange way of talking that she has, right? Where she's, you know, saying things like, oh, you're just another lying old dirty birdie, whatever. Mm-hmm. Forgive me for prattling away, make you feel all oogie. It does this thing where it initially makes her feel so much less threatening, right? She's this wholesome,
infantilizes,
quirky, but you know, fun, nice person. And then once the turn happens, that takes on an entirely different tone. Now every time she says something like that, you're dealing with a psychotic person who is so detached from reality, and this language just serves to reinforce that feeling. It's a really smart use of a character trait to heighten the tension in the scenes.
Yeah, and you can see like the different stages of the Stockholm syndrome, where like, you know, she at first is constrained by her wanting him to have a high regard for her, and then there's the initial couple transgressions where she tries to blow past, and then there's the you're a lying dirty birdie. That's the Rubicon.
Yeah.
Where the movie can't come back from that. And then it's him like reversing, trying to like lull her into like he goes like, I think this, like, once he burns the manuscript, I thought he was just broken, but what I realized is like, no, this is phase in the movie where he knows that now he has to play like this almost traditionally like a feminine type role, where he has to placate this insane aggressor. Like he's the woman being menaced by King Kong, and he has to dance and enrapture her and enthrall her. That's his only defense, because physically he's helpless before her. I thought that was a really cool, and the shifting in this almost odd couple relationship, where like he kind of teases and cajoles and like acts like he's all in on this project and only has reasonable, but and like he has to walk on eggshells, like this conversation with the paper. He's like, well, I got you the best paper in the world. Oh, but you know, this paper, you know, you didn't know any better, but it smudges. And this turns into like, she almost re-breaks his legs over it. It's like fucking crazy. But yeah. I think it worked so well, that ratcheting of the tension. And then in the third act, like her being away from the cabin and giving him that time to like sneak around and stuff. Like, I was having cows during all of those sequences. Just, I was sweating as much as James Caan getting back to his... is like what, like when he gets to a place where he throws himself to the ground and starts crawling around on the floor, and I'm like, oh Jesus, can you even make it back to your wheelchair when you hear the tires coming, much less then to your room and lock it, buddy? You don't even have the key. It's stress me the fuck out.
Oh yeah, there's a lot of that in A few Stephen King movies. Like, I'm thinking of The Shining, right? Where Jack Torrance is menacing his wife, and like she has to placate him, you know, she has to like,
but he hasn't gone full role. He hasn't got the axe out yet. There's right. Like I can still like verbally diffuse the situation, kind of. Yeah.
And then there's a lot of like similarities, I think, like that isolation, you know, up in the Colorado mountains. They both take place there. I feel like there's a little bit of similarities there.
And there's so much great, like, again, the escalation goes in so many different levels and so many different ways of art. Like, you already think by the time he breaks out of his room the first time that Kathy Bates has a screw loose, but there's tension in the fact that her cabin is like a minefield. There's all these like figurines and crap, and there's like very narrow nooks and crannies, and he's got this, he's, you know, not an expert wheelchair user. And
he's got
then
one
he
arm,
finds,
basically.
Right. Then he finds the shrine to him, which takes like the anxiety to a next level. And then he finds a scrapbook.
Oh, yeah.
Where she's been essentially praying and killing people that are physically indisposed before him for like a long, long time. And this combined with number one fan status, like it's like every reveal takes the tension to a whole other level. And I really thought that was great. I also... I thought his plan, like all of his plans, seemed very smart. And at first I'm like, What is he doing? How is he possibly going to drug her? Like, this isn't their relationship. She doesn't take food from him. And is he going to kill himself? Is this some kind of suicide pill? I thought like trying to figure out what exactly he's going to do. But then the whole time, like, oh, this makes sense. He knows he's going to use her knowledge of his rituals and the fact that she wants to be in this world so bad against her. And it's great.
Yeah.
And then, yeah, like I said, the first time I watched this movie is great because like every fucking trick worked on me. Like when she knocked over that wine glass, I almost threw up. It's like, oh God, what now? What? We're all in on the wine plan, James Caan. What's going on?
Yeah. I mean, now you're staring at another, 6 weeks of this? Like you gotta.
Yeah. You can't rush it.
No, you can't.
But then it's like he's played the job of being nice so well, and he's physically recovering because in her mind this is still acceptable behavior. She's still nursing him back to health. All this crazy shit, and that's where he's done everything right. You know, he didn't react to the wine glass, and she just comes in with the sledgehammer and the fucking piece of wood. Oh God!
Yeah, and the penguin.
And I knew, but I'd never actually seen it. Like every single time I've seen that scene in like a top 50 horror scene context or like, like I remember when this was big at the day, like a lot of the advertising used like the buildup to that. And like, you know, with her with the sledgehammer and you just know your mind builds it up. I was wondering if they were actually going to show it. And they did, and it was fucking horrific. They didn't show it. They didn't show both. They just did the one and let your imagination take the other. Yeah. But
no, I mean his legs were already horrific, right? Like breaking them was just like the secondary. It's really hard to watch. I almost can't watch that scene, and I'm a pretty big gruesome horror buff.
Because they really ask you, unlike a lot of things like Hostel and Saw, they really ask you to intensely empathize with this guy and not detach from the experience. So,
and he's the only character, right? Like, he's the only real character that I could ever see myself in a position of. So, yeah, I feel like I'm in the bed there when that happens. Let me ask you this. The memory lane stuff with these photos and the articles about her killings. So she's gone to prison. She's gotten out. There's one article I think that says she's killing babies at some point. Is it possible that she's feeding any of these bodies to her pig? Like, I know that's a thing like other stuff, like the Hannibal, you know, series and stuff, but I didn't get a whiff of that, but maybe. Yeah.
Or Snatch, I should say. Not Snatch, that's past tense. Snatch, present tense. That's a whole other level. That's a well-fed pig. Yeah.
I don't know why else the pig is in there. Did you have any insight into like the pig in general?
I think it's just like my thought was it's an odd offbeat animal. And I don't, yeah, I don't know. I thought there was something there, her naming the main heroine, like the pig after the main heroine in Misery. I thought they were going something with like the fact that there's something kind of simple-minded and ridiculous about being this big of a fan of a romance novel. And I don't know. Like I said, I'm not holding that up for examination and like any kind of truth, because like, you know, if you're into romance novels, you're into romance novels.
Sure.
Don't think you're going to abduct the writers of such and put them through all kinds of medical torture. But I do think that from the frame of the movie itself, he doesn't think much of these people. He has very little real, like obviously he's just shitting out these novels without any kind of regard, and she's treating this as it is like the best thing ever. And then when he writes the thing that he actually tries, she hates it. I think that he's probably writing like when he's just like slamming out chapters for her, he's just writing fan fiction. He's like, I know exactly what you want, and I'm gonna slot. I felt like there was something that like, of course she would have a pet pig and name it Misery because she's so fucking immune to irony. I don't know. But I like your interpretation that she's actually feeding it like babies and shit. That's pretty horrific.
I mean, it is horrific. I don't know if it's true or implied in anything, but
speaking of irony and sarcasm,
feeding bodies. Yeah.
Oh yeah. That's a great call. I love the sheriff and his wife and their relationship.
Oh my God, this guy's great. Yeah.
It's so cool. Like, I like how Rob Reiner has this guy authentically struggle down a snow-covered mountainside.
Right.
Well, this old man is just like sliding and slipping and like, oh God, I'm too old for this. Here goes my hip. And his old lady is got the hots for him, always trying to flirt with him, and he's like trying to be official. And you know, this he's got so many great lines, like, you know, do you need any help? No, I'm really enjoying myself down here. And he had got this other thing about, you know, it's just that kind of sarcasm that gives our marriage some real spice. I just think I loved it. I loved every bit of it. It's just enough, like comic relief, like his. Yeah. He's got a little bit of like a Tommy Lee Jones from Old Country for No Men. No Country for Old Men kind of thing going on, where he's kind of past his prime. It's pretty shocking shit, but he's got the stuff, you know, he's putting together these little clues. And just when you think he's going to be, I guess this is another Stephen King kind of trope, because this is exactly what happens in Shining. You know, Danny gets a hold I forget the guy who calls him Doc, and he's out in Florida, and he comes back to rescue him, and you think, he's going to put one over on the old man, and he gets axed instead. Yeah, like, you think the old sheriff's going to show up, save the day, and he gets a hole blown through him the size of a paint can lid.
I remarked to Alexis, we were watching this together, and when he's driving down the road and when he gets shot, I'm like, oh yeah, this is the Scatman Crothers of this movie.
Exactly.
The thing I really love about the old man is the way he just digs into these novels, these misery novels. Like, he's reading, I can just imagine for a week, 6 weeks, you know, whatever it is, he's sitting here in bed every night next to his wife reading these bodice ripper romance novels.
Oh yeah.
And these, just like examining them, like going through line by line. And
oh yeah,
like the looks that she's giving him the whole time as he's like murmuring to himself that one specific line. It's great. I love it.
Every time a nipple stiffens, every time a turgid member engorges or throbs, he was there. I did think that was pretty, honestly, the resolution of this was pretty fucking corny. Him reading some trial, like, and I guess the fucking library has a scrapbook on Kathy Bates too. Because like, yeah, it wasn't like him scanning through microfiche. There's this one contiguous like thing that he was looking at, and she quotes this random quote in a novel, and that's the thing that's like, oh my God, it's her. She's the one. Yeah. I thought that was the quote matching clue, borderline Harry Potter shit.
It was pretty silly. I was wondering the entire time when he's reading them, how is this possibly going to connect the dots for him? Like, there's nothing in the book that would tell him the location of this guy, but they did just enough. It worked for
me. Yeah, I thought that, like, the whole her horrifying, you know, kind of, you know, Angel of Death routine would have been the clue. Like, oh, I wonder if, and the fact that he knows that she was a big fan of his.
I actually saw her drive by on that mountain road, right? When they were investigating. Exactly. I thought there was a clue.
Yeah, I thought the quote was just like, you didn't need that. Like, that's really, it's not even gilding, it's shittening the lily. you had a nice little, like, escalation of evidence there. And then I really liked their duel in her house, where she knows that he's there and it's bad, and he knows that he's there and it's bad, but, like, neither of them know what the other knows. And, like, there's that scene where she goes to make him tea, and then he peeks out to see if she's looking at him, and then she peeks out, and I thought that was really, it's menacing, but it's also really funny. It's kind of like that scene in, like, the one of the newer John Wicks, where him and, like, Common are shooting each other in a subway with like silenced weapons. It's like this game that only two people know about, and it was good. I'm glad it was in there, because this movie would be a pretty dour experience without the old man.
Oh yeah, you got to get him out there. And when he goes out there and he's like exploring her bedroom and stuff, I'm thinking like, okay, how much incriminating stuff would be out? But she's got this cover story, right? Like, oh, I love these novels. I'm his number one fan. It's inspired me to try and write something. So I set up a makeshift writing studio in this other bedroom.
And what is the line between the biggest fan and fucking crazy behavior, you know?
Sure. Yeah. All big question marks. And the fact that she's a nurse, like, she would have maybe some nursing supplies around, right? So it's not weird that she would have chemicals or bandages in semi-large quantities. It's
in
a
1990,
bit of a stretch.
In 2020, we know this shit doesn't happen. But yeah, 1990, sure. Yeah, she's just stockpiling. Why not?
I can see it's suspicious, but it's not anything that tips her hand. And I think that's the line. That's the tension there. You know, you got to walk right on that line. If you go too far to either side, it doesn't work, and they nail it.
No, yeah, I agree. I want to talk about the hobbling scene, because, and as you mentioned in the book, she amputates his foot. Mm-hmm. And this, she just breaks his legs, man. Like, I don't see how he ever healed from the compound fractures with the, like, backwoods medicine woman, Dr. Quinn shit she was pulling.
Yeah.
Those legs look bad, dude.
Real bad.
Those feet, those weren't James Caan's actual feet. Those were prosthetic feet.
They're gelatin molds that they put around his feet, and he could kind of slip in at the knees.
Okay, because I thought that he was actually going to get gangrene or something. Like, there's an open question in my mind of, like, how much medical skill does she actually have? Mm-hmm. But apparently she can nurse him back to health. She breaks his ankles. Goldman, who wrote the script, said that he thought it was a good decision to switch it to hobbling from amputation, because the visual depiction of amputation would cause the audience to hate Annie instead of sympathizing with her madness. I don't know what film he watched. I hated Annie.
Oh, me too.
I hated Annie before this scene. She's the worst. Like, I mean, I'm capable of sympathizing with what the fuck happened to her that she came out wired like this.
But they don't try to go there at all, right? They don't ever give a backstory that is anything but
just
horrific.
A little. She refers to, like, how hard it's been for her to make friends because of her temper. And, like, how hard it was to fit in and things like that. But, like, yeah, like, I think you get a pretty good picture by the time everything's, but, like, yeah, was her mom this way? Did she get dropped on her head? Did she just got, like, is this running her family? I don't think that this was better than a full-on amputation. Like, honestly, the sledgehammer, wood block, breaking ankles might be worse than just a clean slice with an axe, as far as, like, in your head kind of pain scale thing. It's not permanent, I guess.
Yeah, I don't know.
This guy walking without a cane at any point in his life, I'm not buying. Like, I think this is pretty bad shit to go through at his age, for sure.
Yeah. No, they were equally horrific in my mind. There was fundamentally no difference between taking his foot off versus breaking both of his ankles like this.
Wait, the foot off, like, it made me think of Nick Cage. You know,
okay, yeah, that's
the way
the
he does
sequel.
The line where you get foot off.
That's the sequel directed by Quentin Tarantino.
Yeah. The quote, James Caan, you sick, twisted fuck.
yep, eat it.
Yeah, eat it. Eat it till you choke.
God, did you, speaking of his leg, did you see the fucking sweep the leg Johnny kick that he does at the end of that?
Yeah. Oh, their fight. Like, I think this is another thing that must have been shocking in 1990s. Like a full-on James Caan versus Kathy Bates fight with, like, thumbs stabbed in the eyes. Mm-hmm. And knifings, and like it's like the blood pouring down her face was wild.
And
it
Kathy
was really
Bates
wild.
Is like the perfect choice for this because of her size, right? She's a large woman, and I feel like that size gives her a real
imposing presence. Because it's not just that James Caan is hobbled. She fireman carries him up this steep slope that the old man is going to later struggle with.
Uh-huh.
Like, this is a substantial woman.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, this is a woman of some stature. So, you know, if you got hobbledy legs, it's pretty dicey.
Yeah.
I also thought it was, like, really a nice touch that they name-checked Liberace in the movie. And then the way they ended the credits with "I'll be seeing you" and all the old familiar places. That's such a stalker song when you play it right after the movie Misery.
Huh.
After he kind of zones out. Because, like, I thought the way this ended with him kind of in recovery and he's rewritten the great American novel and he's getting accolades and... you know, his agent, of course, tries to push him like, hey, you got to tell, this is an amazing story. You need to tell it. And he's like, and then this waitress comes up and says, I'm your number one fan. And he's got that kind of like glass eyed deer in the headlights look. And it fades to, I'll be seeing you. I was just taking my notes as the song was playing. I'm like, damn, this is the perfect song to end this movie on. Hmm. It's a great, like, yeah, sitting there in stunned silence while you're watching the credits play. Type of song, and it was nice. One other thing I want to talk about, I don't know if you got a bunch of stuff to talk about, but talk about Roger Ebert's surprisingly savage 3-star review of this movie?
Oh, what did he say? I didn't read it.
It's one of those things that's 3 out of 4 stars. You think, hey, it's a pretty good movie. That's a good movie, but mm-hmm. he does so many drive-bys and kind of snide. Side swipes at this movie, and then it culminates into this final paragraph. It's a good story, a natural, and it grabs us, but just as there is almost no way to screw it up, there's hardly any way to bring it above a certain level of inspiration. Many competent directors could have done what Reiner does here, and perhaps many other actors could have done what Caan does, mm-hmm. although the Kathy Bates performance is trickier and more special. The result is good craftsmanship and a movie that works. It does not illuminate, challenge, or inspire, but it works. Damn!
I mean,
Roger.
He's not wrong.
Did this movie beat him up and take his lunch money? Like, this is some damned faint praise of a 3-star movie. I don't know. To me, this is like, it feels weird because I think this movie perfectly did everything it set out to.
Yes.
I don't think there was a false note in it. And even the kind of weird retro workman-like filming, I think, worked. I actually think it's a deliberate choice to kind of harken back to, you know, like a little 1970s feel when the world was a little bit smaller and less connected, even than in 1990. Mm-hmm. But damn, yeah, like the fact that it's like, well, you know, it's as good as you can make out of a Stephen King book. Oh, I think he might have an axe to grind against Stephen King. Here's how he describes Stephen King, opening sentence of the review. I love you, Roger Ebert, wherever you are, but still, damn. Stephen King has a modest but undeniable genius for being able to find horror in everyday situations.
Wow, modest but undeniable. Jeez.
I mean, I think they're right. He'd be the type of guy that describes what he does as, like, you know, I have a modest but undeniable genius in reviewing movies, because it's like, you know, you're not splitting the atom. You're not stitching people's spinal cords back together. You're not painting Sistine Chapels. You're just writing some of the finest horror in the 20th and 21st century. Like,
yeah, literally the last 4 decades are dominated by the horror of Stephen King. It's not even a contest who is the biggest horror writer. Say Stephen King has a modest talent for writing horror is completely ludicrous.
You're essentially
in my opinion.
Edgar Allan Poe, except you got out of the ditch in the throes of alcoholism and kept living and thrive, you know, like, you didn't end it all before you got, it's like, it's, I don't know. I felt like I could hear the axe grinding, the sharpening stone grinding in the background. I don't know.
I agree more with his last paragraph than I do that first sentence, because the last paragraph says, essentially, this won't change your life, right? This isn't going to make you see the world differently.
It works.
He's correct. But like you said, every note they go for, they hit perfectly. I don't think there's anything to dislike about this movie.
And I don't think it's actually pretty hard to do what Kathy Bates does here, she goes for it, but never in an over the top way. Mm-hmm. Like it always feels great. Like this feels like a person with real issues that is not, you know, because crazy people are often played as like random and chaotic, but she's got like an internal system of rules that she kind of abides by at every, you know, like it's hard to make a person like that feel like the way that like Khan's able to trick and manipulate her. Like he had to really invest time and effort into pulling that off. It wasn't like she's not easy to fool, I guess is what I'm saying.
Yeah.
And you know, for Khan to play this role too, without, you know, seeming like a helpless victim, like, you know, still is not a broken person. It keeps fighting till the end.
Yeah.
It's like I said, like I said, I don't want to sound like Michael Jordan, but when I saw that he gave a 3-star review and said this in his concluding paragraph, I took it personal.
The other final thing I guess I want to talk about is I mentioned I was watching this with my wife, and she's a very, very big Stephen King fan. She's got almost all of his books that he's written.
She has a shrine, would you say, in your living room?
Yeah, she's his number one fan. I asked her, like, there were a couple things in this I was looking at and saying, oh, that poster on the wall for the wanted for theft or whatever in the sheriff's office, is that a reference to Stephen King? She's like, not that I know of. And I kept asking her questions like that, and it was always no. And I was thinking, there aren't a lot of Stephen King like Easter eggs in this. And then I remembered, this is 1990. And I don't know that television was doing much of the Easter egg stuff back then. I don't even know the movies were. I think Twin Peaks might have been kind of one of the early adopters of Easter eggs and like self-referential things.
I don't even know if it's like quite the same level of Easter eggs that, like, you know, like that you're right. Like that's an internet thing where people like, uh-huh, it'd be one thing, like maybe one, you'd have one little tell in a movie, but now it's like you watch a modern Marvel film and there's like 15 in a trailer.
Yeah.
That like places will be happy to point out to you, and they're expecting you to freeze frame and get it. And
or you look at Castle
Mickeys
Rock,
and,
right? The TV show. There's a billion Stephen King references.
Every single frame is packed.
Annie like herself is in an episode of Castle Rock later on. So,
Yep. So, but yeah, I did 30 years later, this movie's aged like a vintage Dom Perignon, I guess.
Dom Perignon, yep.
Dom Perignon. I honestly have no idea how to pronounce that, if that's correct or not.
Sure, it's a Dom French
Perignon.
Word,
Perignon. Mm-hmm. Well, that'll be it for our coverage of Misery, but we are going to have one last anniversary movie coming out this year, and it'll probably close out our season of Bald Move Prestige. Tom Hanks' Castaway is what we're going to be considering. It's its 20-year anniversary coming up real soon. It's one of those, I don't think it's actually a Christmas movie. It could be a Christmas movie because he's traveling during the holidays. That starts it all out.
Maybe.
I'll be looking to see if there's a Christmas song. If there's a Christmas song, then yeah, it's absolutely a Christmas movie. Oh, yeah. But we'll be closing out our season of that. Also, you know, for club members, we're doing our Christmas celebration. So if you want to hear us discussing movies in a fun caroling kind of way. Mm-hmm. We've got The Holiday, little rom-com action. We got Lethal Weapon. Yes, it's a Christmas movie. That's right. You know, if your tastes lie more towards the action, and we got a super special super Christmas movie coming out the week of Christmas. Those are exclusively for club or Patreon patrons. If you want to get in on that, it's real easy. You can go to support.baldmove.com, get signed up today. Otherwise, we'll see you on Castaway. And until then, I'm Aaron.
And I'm Jim.
See ya.